I was in a bar one time, and a fellow came in and sat down next to me, and he ordered a double whiskey, and the bartender gave it to him, and he took it and knocked it down and sat there for a little while. And he looked in his pocket like this. And he looked back at the bartender and said, "I'll have another double whiskey." Got his double whiskey, knocked it down. Kind of looked around, looked down in his pocket. Had one more. Double whiskey. Looked in his pocket. Said, what are you doing? He said, "Well, I look in my pocket. I have a picture of my wife there, and when she starts looking good, I know it's time to go home." I am so very, very joyful to be here this morning. I was sharing with Santiago, this is just a miracle for me. When I think of my life before AA, there were really, really important parts of life that were not part of my life, and joy was absolutely something that I don't think I ever experienced in my active addiction. And today it is so very, very different, and joy happens in such wonderfully miraculous, special ways. And to see all of you here this morning and to know the common bond we share and the dreams and the hopes is just very, very joyful. And I'm very, very joyful to have three very special speakers here from different parts of the country. We're going to share with you, and if there's a little time left, I'll share a few words of my own. I want to introduce our three speakers. And when I asked each of them what I could say about them, their primary thing was, "Well, I'm a sober alcoholic," and they are all very, very humble and very cool people. And we're going to start off with Santiago, and then Joe, and then Mary. Santiago is from California, and he's been sober for about 33 years, and he's a pretty cool guy. Help me welcome Santiago.
It's 9:01. My name's Santiago, and I'm an alcoholic. What is joy? What is joy? This is it. This is it. Joy to me is one thing and many, but the main thing that it is that it is expansive. It knows no end. It knows no end. Joy is expansive. Happiness happens. It's eventual. But joy expands. It just keeps on going and going and going. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not very close to joy. In fact, I don't think I knew what joy was. I came here in 1976. It was August 16th, 1976. I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and a man came, picked me up, and took me to a meeting in Newport Beach, California. It was a beginner's meeting, Thursday. And that man, his name is Bill, and he was a man who remained my friend throughout my whole sobriety, and he passed away about a year ago. But he was always there for me. And he was the greatest example I ever had of how Alcoholics Anonymous works. And it works joyfully. If we're working the steps, if we're conscious of how important unity is and how important service is, we're going to be joyful. That's my experience. I started drinking when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and it blows my mind that I was that young. I have grandchildren, one that's 8, one that's 13, and one that's going to be 16. And I look at my 8-year-old and grandson and can't imagine that I was drinking, I was using, I was breaking into people's houses. I was doing everything that crazy people do who drink and use drugs. And I cleaned up when I was 12 years old. I used to hang around with these vatos, which in English means dudes. And back in those days, we used to wear khakis, and we used to wear them real high. kind of like the way the Filipinos used to wear their pants back then. And we'd wear French toes, third guy shirt tied up in the back, and then we used to stand around like this. That's called a joyful position. It required a lot of discipline, because even if your shorts got stuck there in the North Pole, you still had to stand like this. So I did actually kind of calm down when I was 12 years old, and I learned to drink by myself, I learned to smoke by myself, I learned to do all kinds of things by myself. Joyful things. Actually, those are happy things, because they don't last that long, you know. It happens and it's gone. Anyway, for men, you know. Very limited. Very narrow. Women are expansive. I want to thank the committee and everybody who was involved in putting the conference together and inviting us here. And it's an honor to be here with two sober alcoholic women and a young sober alcoholic man. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two neighbors. My neighbor on my right was fear, and my neighbor on my left was more fear. I was totally surrounded by fear. I had grown up in this little barrio in Anaheim, California, and I had ended up at the University of Idaho, where I was a director of student development. I was a professor. I was interviewing at Stanford University, and I was loco, completely loco. When I was flying to Stanford for the interview, I went to the bathroom on the airplane right before we had a little bit of time, so I got to go before we took off, and I had a big fat burrito. That's a great big fat joint. I took a big hit off of it, and I took off before the airplane did. I interviewed there, and then I interviewed at the University of California, Irvine, and got the job at UCI, which was wonderful because it got me back home. I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous in 76, but I went back out. You know, I went back out, and I went back out because I thought that I could drink again. I thought, you know, if I drank again, would the world split in half? And then I thought, God, I got to find out. So I drank. I drank a little can of Coors. And then I woke up in the morning and there was quarts of Coors all over my bedroom. And so eventually I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm so blessed that the men and women here in Alcoholics Anonymous were willing to welcome me back. And in fact, they kept saying, keep coming back. And I really thought they were just talking about me, you know. Like, God, they must really like me. And the thing is, you know, that they really did like me. In fact, what I understand now is that they loved me. They cared about me. And they made me a goal. And they made sure that I knew that it was important to understand that if I didn't take that first drink, I wouldn't have to worry about the next drink. They told me that if I was going to be sober, I had to be sober all the way. And they told me if I was going to be sober, I had to give it away. I couldn't keep it. And I had to be sure to try to remember, which I don't always. I'm sorry to confess that I don't, but I do most of the time, is to welcome anybody who's new here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome you, and I'm sure my brothers and sisters who are here who have a few days want to welcome you. We're going to have another 24 hours of sobriety today, another 24 hours, another miracle. Science cannot explain how it is that it happens that this kind of brain, which I know now for a fact scientifically because it was they did a brain mapping on me. There's this Chinese psychiatrist, and he said to me not too long ago, he goes, "You got very interesting brain, doc. Very interesting. I like to take pictures of it." So, you know, they took a lot of pictures. And when he was done, he goes, "Oh, my, you got chaotic brain." So I have chaos in my brain. And because I am who I am, that's not enough. So I make sure I get plenty of caffeine. So, you know. The other thing he said is, he said, one thing though, doctor, very interesting. You make chaotic brain quiet. How do you do that? And I was very fortunate that the man who brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, my good friend, and to me really was the person who was always my sponsor, the person who I didn't keep any secrets from, and the person in my life who probably loved me most unconditionally than any other human being that I've ever met in my life, except for my wife, who I adore. And those two people, you know, to be loved unconditionally is tremendous. And so he taught me early on, because I asked him, I said, and I'll be very frank about this, I said, you know, I was 31 years old. You can believe that. I was. And I asked him, I said, you know, I wish I had the same kind of hunger and the same kind of desire that I have for women. You know what I mean? Because women are so beautiful, and they're just, God, they're just from another world, and I have no problem looking at them and keeping my attention on them. Because that's because you're a dog. I said, I want to learn how to be able to do that with God. How could I have that kind of hunger, that kind of desire for God? And he says, well, first you have to learn to sit down and be still. And you'll have a lot of opportunities in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to sit down and be still. And then you have to learn to sit down and be still and don't talk when other people are talking. Remember to be respectful. Remember that this is all about us working together and carrying the message and making sure that the newcomer gets that message. And then little by little, focus on one thing. One thing. It can be good. It can be joy. It can be bliss. It can be Jalisco. You know, whatever you want to focus on, but just focus on one thing. And so I began to practice that 32 years ago. And I have never given up on practicing that. To sit down, to be still, and to focus on goodness. The word God, the derivation of that word is German, good. And it means to invoke goodness. Dio, Theo, Dios, is God, is another way of saying that God. And that also means to invoke goodness. I think that all spiritual paths agree in one thing. You cannot have a spiritual experience by just thinking about it. We have to do something. And to sit down and be still and think about good requires energy, attention, and concentration. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me. It gives me an opportunity every time I go to a meeting to try to focus and to try to listen and to try to concentrate on what those people are saying. Now, I cannot do that successfully. Can you? See, because the mind does not work that way. My mind loves to remember. My mind either remembers or it plans. Remember? Yeah. See, and what I remember is that for me, and I have to say this is my experience. And my home group is the Men's Stag Munchie Meeting in Laguna Niguel. It's a 1-hour meeting, and it's just such a fantastic group of men, you know, that are helping each other. And the thing that just, you know, gives me so much joy is not so much what people say, but what people do there at that meeting, what these men do for each other. We care about each other. We support each other. We show up. And that, to me, is what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about showing up. It's about being willing to give and also to receive. And so when I came here, I had been trying to stop drinking since I was 18 years old. I never, and the reason what I was getting to about the meeting is that meeting is the number of guys who say, man, I had a really good time drinking. You know, I cannot say that in all honesty. I just did not have a really good time drinking. I drank a lot as fast as I could because I liked that first boom. And then I drank more, and then I spent at least 1 to 3 hours dry heaving the next morning. And I was such an idiot that I didn't learn to take that drink. I just didn't drink for 8 hours, then I started drinking again. So I had been trying to stop drinking since I was 18 years old. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was divorced. I spit in my wife's face. I had been arrested 2 times. I had driven my car drunk many, many times with my children in the car in the daytime, at nighttime. One time I left my son in a van in Idaho, and I went into a bar. I had a tremendous craving for drinking, and I went into the bar, and I forgot my son was in the van. And I came back out. He was 4 years old or 5, and he was crying, and his hands were on the window. You know, and I don't ever want to forget that. I don't ever want to forget what I did. That young man now is 39 years old. He's a professor at university. My daughter is 42. She's a professor at a university. And they love me. And my daughter had me walk her down the aisle. I don't want to forget where I came from. I don't want to forget what alcohol can do to this already chaotic brain. I don't want to forget. And so I make it my business not to forget. And the way I do that is by remembering, bringing the members back together and understanding that I have a disease and that this disease can kill me and it can kill you. Because it doesn't just kill me. I can get in the car and I can kill a number of people. Or I could go crazy and get a machine gun and God knows what, you know. So it's very, very important for me not to forget. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and the first time, you know, I wasn't successful. When I came back the second time, it was made real clear to me that I needed to be sure that I got to meetings early. It was made real clear to me that I had to be sure that I was participating in some way, that I was setting up chairs or breaking down chairs or doing something to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous in some way. And that became the foundation of my program. And one of the things that I've loved doing over the years is I love to do retreats. And I went to my first retreat before I had a year of sobriety. And there was probably over 80, 90 men at that retreat. And eventually what I thought would be wonderful is to be able to have a retreat where men could go and we could meditate and we could pray and we could focus on the 12 steps. And a number of us men got together and we put that retreat together. It's in a monastery in California, 20 men, 22 men. And that's what we do. You know, we practice being still and being quiet. And throughout my life, I've always heard, you know, alcoholics say, that's impossible. It's impossible for me to keep my mind still. Well, you know what? It is. It is almost impossible. But if I sit still and I focus on good, Alcoholics Anonymous is good. Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle. Alcoholics Anonymous is joy. And it doesn't stop growing. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But it does eventually dissipate. It does eventually disappear. And when it does, usually, it's because I'm not working the steps and I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. And let me tell you something. I know how to do that. I know how not to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I continue to be a student of learning how to do that. And it's my desire to do that. But I fail. I fail because I'm not perfect. But my desire does not fail. My desire continues because that's what I want. I have been so blessed here in Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to be here at this moment, to be able to have lived 65 years, to have been able to go to Vietnam and serve off the coast of North Vietnam and be so drunk in the middle of a night on a ship. I mean, those of you who are in the Navy, when you're out there at nighttime, they lock everything down. There are no lights. And I was out there so drunk, I couldn't walk outside on the ship by myself, slipping and sliding. And I wasn't taking a shower. I was just slipping and sliding. And, you know, praying to God that I didn't fall overboard. And now I'm here. We're all here. And there's people here from all over the world. And we are living joy. We are being joy. And it's my belief that we come from joy. That is the source of life. That is the source of light. That is the source of everything on this universe. Is joy. And we have the choice of whether we want to live in joy and be in joy. We have that choice. I have that choice, but I don't always choose it. I forget. But eventually, because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the service in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm shook and I am awoken and I remember that I can live in joy. And when this body dies and this personality is done and the TV is turned off for this little box, I believe right now, right here, that I will return to joy. Because joy is everything. And we are part of that. I love you. I'm so grateful to each one of you for being here this morning and for coming to this convention. So let's rock on, and God bless you.
Thank you, Santiago. Our next speaker is Jo. She hails from Anchorage. A.K. somebody says that Arkansas. Are you sure? No, A.K. is Alaska. She's here for her fourth international convention, and she wanted me to let you know that the International Women's Convention will be in Anchorage soon. So help me welcome Jo.
Good morning. My name is Joe, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Slap Happy Group in Anchorage, Alaska. My sobriety date is October 11, 1985. I like that there's a little clock here, but it's flashing, so I hope it keeps moving along so I can keep track. Wow. This is Friday morning, and I'm sober. I was not up all night. I got to go to bed, and I still like the snooze button when the alarm goes off. Rushing a little bit at the last minute to get out the door. I didn't start drinking until I was legal age because I was not going to be an alcoholic. That was my plan. And it didn't take me too long, and I got into some other outside issues that brought me to my knees pretty darn quick, seems like, and in other ways it seems like it took way too long. But I remember reading the newspaper and seeing an ad for some 12-step program if you had this other little problem. And I called that number and talked to this woman, and she said she'd meet me at a meeting. And we talked, and she said, wow, it really sounds like you might have a problem with alcohol. And she walked over to a little file cabinet that had the little AA on it, and she pulled out a big book and she handed it to me. She suggested I read the first 164 pages and go find a sponsor and start working the steps. I did not take her suggestion. I needed to go do some more research. And after a couple weeks, I called her again. She said, I'll meet you at a meeting. So we did this little dance for a little while in the summer of 1985. And a couple years before that, I had gone to this treatment program because I thought I had this little problem, and I wanted to do it my way. I didn't want to go into his little treatment program. And finally, then, in October of 85, I went back to that treatment program, and they still had my file. And they gave me a big book and a 12 and 12, and they gave me a meeting schedule, and they told me to go to meetings and get a sponsor and start working the steps. And that morning, I went to my dad, and I asked him for help. I asked him to pay for me to go to treatment because I had this little problem. And he was surprised. He's like, you don't even smoke cigarettes. How can you have a drinking problem? Dad, you do not need to smoke cigarettes to have a problem, trust me. The reason I teared up is I'm coming up on the one-year anniversary of his death. About a year after I got sober, he moved from Alaska to Arizona. And every time I went to visit him, he would give me the keys to his car. And I would call the intergroup office, and I'd say I'm looking for a meeting, and kind of, you know, what part of nearby where my dad lived, because Phoenix area is a little big. And he would tell me how to get to, you know, whatever the meeting was, you know, whatever night of the week or the time or whatever. But he never discouraged me from going to meetings. And even though my dad never got sober, He was always there for me. And I am so grateful for that, because I get to live life sober today, and that just amazes me. When I got sober, I was so terrified of people. I liked the small meetings of maybe 10 tops, and I liked candlelight meetings because the rooms were dark. They even had the same little candles like what they had at the bar that I worked at, you know, with a little red glass. And that's where I felt comfortable at when I came into these rooms. And by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship, I've had the opportunity to go to school and to get a degree and to start working a career and being a productive member of society. I got to go down and visit my dad in the last couple years especially. My sister and I got to work together and go take turns. She lived on the East Coast. I lived in Alaska, and Dad's in Arizona. And it's like, well, he couldn't have got much farther away unless he lived in San Diego or something. But we took turns to go down and help and do whatever, moving, you know, whatever kind of stuff was going on. And I got to do that, and I got to be sober, and I got to give back to him. And I get to be of service to my elderly mother today. And when I go to meetings, I get to extend my hand to the newcomer, and I get to do all kinds of things to help out so that Alcoholics Anonymous is still there. When I got sober, I used to pick up ashtrays because I was too scared to go talk to people, but I could go pick up an ashtray. And I became secretary at my home group at the time. And last night I was at dinner, and there were, out of 10, there were like 5 of us that were all at that old home group that all got sober about the same time together in the mid-80s back in the Sunshine Group in Anchorage. You know, and so we all got to converge. And some of us only see each other like every 5 years, and there's a little crowd of former Alaskans in the back corner. And, you know, there's a whole lot of former Alaskans in here. I look around the room, and I see folks that I know from other service assemblies. You know, and it's just incredible. This life today is absolutely mind-blowing in my book. Sometimes I get complacent, I get lazy, I forget about it, I take things for granted, get my little carcass to a meeting, and I sit there and I listen, and I hear others, and I pay attention, and I get to work with others, and, you know, it just amazes me on how Alcoholics Anonymous works. And the gift that I have today is that I get to be sober today. Is I get to get up and come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with, you know, there's at least hundreds in here, but this whole weekend, there's a lot of folks here in San Antonio. And it's just amazing. You know, I can't simply say that I'm grateful. All I can do is show it, because I believe that gratitude is an action word. You know, I can sit here and talk about it all I want, but if I'm not doing something to show my gratitude by carrying the message, you know, our primary purpose is to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic. You know, that's what my business is. That's what my responsibility is. When I first got sober, the woman who said that I probably had a little problem and suggested I go to meetings, she also encouraged me to get involved in service work. I went to a couple meetings, and I didn't really pay a lot of attention, and it was overwhelming, and I was confused and a little bit of a mess, and I didn't get too involved for a while. And kind of life happened, and like I said, I wound up going to school and getting a degree. And when I graduated, then I got a lot more involved in my home group and going to meetings more and getting involved in general service. And I have had the privilege of a lot of growth and opportunities and love and fellowship. And sometimes I feel like the whole state of Alaska is my home group now. I've been able to travel around that whole state. I have gone to places that normally a lot of people don't get to. I've been to a lot of villages throughout the state. And a lot of that was for my job, which I would not have been able to do had I still been out there drinking and going crazy. In fact, I probably would have been sitting on the other side of my desk. And it is such a gift and such a blessing and such a miracle that I get to live a sober life today. Sometimes I don't entirely understand how that happens, but it does. I was handed a God when I was a little child that I didn't care for and I struggled with. And I had some difficulty with that. And when my first sponsor was taking me through the steps, and talking to me about the steps and higher power and could I believe in something, because I told her I wasn't too keen on the God that I had, I said, yeah, there's probably something out there, and I didn't know what. And I still believe that there is something out there, and I still don't know what, but I do know that there is a power greater than me. I was watching a little YouTube a couple weeks ago. Actually, it was a friend of mine, lives up on the hillside in Anchorage, and there was a moose that gave birth to two calves out in his yard. He didn't get to film the first calf being born because by that time, you know, he realized what was going on, so then he was able to grab his camera, and he videotaped that second calf being born. And I sat there and I watched that, and I thought, you know, if, you know, that just, there's something out there, you know, there's something to be able to watch that, you know, on how that all happened, on how the moose was able to do, you know, what needed to be done, and watch the other one little kind of wobble around and skinny little legs. And it just more proof to me that there is a higher power, and I just don't know what it is, and I don't quite understand it, and I don't have to understand it. I just know that there is. I have learned to trust the process today. I don't always understand when I'm in the middle of something why it is or what's going on, and sometimes I will, like, God, what are you doing? But I have just learned to just show up, keep putting one foot in front of the other, and to trust the process. And then it all works out. And that's not anything I ever could have done when I was out there drinking. You know, I had to control things. I had to know. I was too terrified. I hung out in that little bar. I mean, the bar was a dive. Even the floor was crooked. Low ceiling. You had to bend over to walk in the door. And it was just a dark little dive. But that's what I felt comfortable in when I got in here. And today, I hardly ever go into bars anymore. A friend of mine asked me to, this is really bizarre, a friend of mine asked me to accompany her the other night. She wanted to go to a show that was in a bar, and she asked me to be her designated driver, and I said, okay. And I hadn't done something like that in a really long time, and it was like, okay, and it was like waiting forever for the show to start, and finally it did. And, you know, it was an okay experience. Do I want to do it again? Probably not. Yet I enjoyed her company and her companionship, and I got to be of service to her. And she was all worried about me and what if I relapse. And I said, no, I know I can go anywhere and I can do anything as long as I have a good connection with God. You know, that's the bottom line, and that's what my big book says. I can go anywhere and do anything as long as I have a reason to be there, and we can go to the most sordid spot on earth. And trust me, I have been in a few sordid spots. And I have been there sober. You know, I have had the privilege of traveling around the state of Alaska to some pretty interesting little locations. And I've done some things even in Anchorage, and it's such a gift, such a miracle. And I normally do a lot of praying when I'm in an oddball situation or something that's a little got me stressed, is I'm doing a lot of praying. And a lot of my prayers are simply, thank you, God. That's a lot of my prayers. Nothing fancy, nothing ritualistic, just a simple thank you, God. And that's how I start a lot of my mornings before I even get out of bed, while I'm hitting that snooze alarm a few times. It's starting with a serenity prayer and thank you, God. The joy of living. I don't always have this exuberant, bubbling, overwhelming, you know, dancing, bouncing off the walls. I can do that just about any time still. Too much coffee will do it. Yet what I have, I think, is more of a contentment more often. I guess contentment is the best word, as I seem to have a lot more of that. There certainly are times that there's a lot of this effervescent, you know, bouncing up and down sort of stuff too. And yet there's also times that I'm down, is that I'm either stressed or I'm blue or I'm sad or whatever. I get to feel a whole range of emotions today. I'm a human being, and I get to feel a whole range of emotions, and I get to acknowledge them. I get to acknowledge the grief that I feel about my dad's passing. And I'm not running and picking up a drink over that. It's not that I, you know, can't handle it or something. And yeah, I feel sad, and I miss my dad, and I know it's all part of the process. And I'm grateful for what my dad was able to give to me. And I still get to be there for my mother. And, you know, I'm not hanging out in the bar. I'm not stuck in the bar. And quite frankly, I don't think I would have lived till 30 if I was still out there. I was drinking hard and fast. I could get off work at 4:30, and I could be at the bar by 4:35, the first place to get booze, even before the very first liquor store. And there was a bartender there. Her name is Tammy, and I didn't drink there every single night, and I did work there part-time while I had this other full-time job. And one day I called in sick to the to work the job that I had at the time, and which that wasn't too unusual. I called in sick a lot. And this was during the day, so Tammy was receiving the weekly liquor delivery. And she stood there, and she looked at me, and she said, I got sick of running out of what you drank, so I ordered 7 bottles. And I looked over at the Chugach Mountains there in Anchorage, and I thought, oh, wow, and I'm really drinking that much. Of course, that didn't slow me down at all. So a little bit more time went by, and like I said, I got involved in general service, and I guess it's been several years ago now that I was asked to serve as treasurer for Area 2. And normally I would take the deposit, and I'd prepare it, and I could run across the street from my office on a break and deposit it in one of the branches there across the street. And I didn't get over there that particular week yet, and I was driving down Northern Lights Boulevard, and patience is not one of my strong suits. And I saw the little drive-up at this other branch, and I thought, oh, no line, man, I'll just pour right in, you know. And my former bartender, Tammy, was the teller at the bank. And, of course, she's got the little nameplate, you know, outside her window. There's no nameplate on my vehicle identifying who I am. But she looked at me, and she's like, I know you. She says, I forget your name, but I know what you drank. And I told her, yeah. And I told her that I was serving as the treasurer for AA in Alaska, and I had the deposit, which I put in a little box, and she just had this huge grin on her face. So, you know, more at that time I was about 18 years sober, I think. So, you know, she still remembered what I drank, although she couldn't remember my name. And that's okay. That really is okay, and I'd much rather run into her in that kind of a circumstance, you know, than something else, some other way. I kind of feel like I'm about out of time. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm really grateful that as many people as are here this weekend, I am really grateful for the folks back home in my home group and the meetings back in Anchorage who were there. For the folks that are crawling in who need this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Our next speaker is Mary. She's from Needham, Massachusetts. She said to tell you she's a convention virgin. She's been sober 22 years. You know, I was just thinking, when you go to a business kind of thing and you're introducing people and you have all these pages of where they went to school and the awards they've had and all the things they did. And these people are just so very, very special and so humble. And please help me welcome Mary.
Oh, good morning. My name is Mary Niederkorn, and I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to God, AA, and sponsorship, I've been sober since November 4, 1987. Yay! My home group is the Brookline Sunday Morning Meeting. We meet on Sunday morning, in the name, duh, I can't blank on when my home group meets. I'm so nervous. We're in the police station, so you can find us if you come by. I got to sleep last night because I comforted myself thinking, tomorrow it's 9 o'clock, it's going to be raining, there'll probably be 20 people in the room. Oh, my God. I'd like to thank the committee, and Hank, thank you very much for a wonderful job of cheering, and Santiago and Joe for giving great talks. I'm a little intimidated because in my area, when we speak, we go in order of sobriety. And so I feel like, oh, my God, you know, the baby up here is the last one to speak, although Hank's got that problem, not me. Ha ha. It's 9:37, so I want to remind myself so I can anybody do the math on that for me? So my sponsor can. I can't even do adding. Anyway, a lot of times when I get a topic, I panic. You know, I think, so I got the email, you know, that said, we would like you to speak at 9 o'clock. And I'm like, speak? On the joy of living. Joy of living, what's that? Oh, my God. What's that? The joy of living. I don't know. I don't know. I've never heard that term before. So, like, when I was, you know, finally, like, the room came back into focus, I dialed my sponsor, and I said, joy of living, where's that in the literature? Where's that in the literature? She goes, it's in the 12 and 12. So, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12-step, and action is its key word. Here we turn outward toward our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. When the 12th step is seen in its full implication, it is really talking about the kind of love that has no price tag on it. The other thing I need to tell you about me is my sponsor reminded me this morning. I said, I'm going to cry, and she said, your hallmark is crying. And I have a Kleenex provided by my sister, who is here and is such a huge gift to me, just so precious to me, and really a symbol of how the program works, that she is here and we're in one another's lives. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not think what my problem was alcohol. I did not think I was alcoholic. In fact, I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous with a diagnosis, which I demanded out of the psychiatrist that was analyzing me. And my diagnosis, I said, what is wrong with me? He said, you have an inadequate personality. Yes, I do. And what are you going to do about it? You know, and we all know what that means, right? I didn't say, what exactly do you mean by that? I knew instinctively, intuitively what that meant. And so I did not think what my problem was alcoholism. I did not know what alcoholism was. I had two goals when I came to AA. I wanted to sleep through the night, and I wanted to be okay with being miserable. And that was the bar that I set for myself. I figured, the people in AA, they're not drinking. They're miserable. But they look okay. They look okay with it. So I'll go to AA, and I'll get okay with being miserable. And I was going to be the woman on the street with the old house that needed to be painted that had 45 cats that nobody went to on Halloween. You know, I mean, that was like, but I thought, well, I'd have my AA meeting, and I'd go there, and, you know, people would know who I was, and I'd get a cup of coffee eventually, you know, occasionally. It's ridiculous. I mean, one of the reasons I love this topic is because I don't have to dwell on what I was like. You know, I get to talk about what has happened to me, and it's just miracle after miracle. I have been showered with blessings. So where to start with all that? When I was preparing my remarks, I came across something at work just this past week. I work part-time as an HR, human resources manager, and I'm also an actress. So this was from the human resources thing. It gives the definition of congruence, which is a psychological term for the harmony we feel when the various areas of our lives, including our motivations and achievements, are in balance. And I thought that was so great because, you know, you have those, like, God shots, right? I had one last night. This is bizarre. My sister was coming in late, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm speaking tomorrow morning at 9. We're not going to have time to go over to the registration list and stand in that line from hell forever and get her registered. So I still went up to the guy, and I said, my sister's coming in, and everything's going to speak at 9 o'clock. I've got to get the line. He goes, run over there, fill out the form, come on, whatever's back. You know, and the guy says, I go, it's me. He goes, you know, it's like 8:05, you know, and they got to let the convention people go. So I run up, and I say, it's me, and he goes, okay. So he walks me up a little bit into the line, to the head of the line, and he puts his hand on this woman whose back is to me, and he says, I'm sorry, I need to let this woman cut right in front of you because she has to get somebody registered before the morning. It was my sponsee. She looks at me, she goes, did you do this on purpose? So, you know, my God, he's connected, right? He's like the mafia. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, my God, you know. So, and that was just last night. So in my area, one of the things we talk about is, you know, I got into the steps and, you know, and I got active with a home group. And I really hated all of you. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do these steps. You know, I'm going to do one step a week, and I'll be, you know, perfectly fine. And we have a definition of two-stepping, which I'm sure isn't unique necessarily. This water's making me crazy. I'm going to put it down here because otherwise I'm going to spill it. My life is unmanageable. Now let me share that with you. Which is what I did for like the first 8 years that I was sober, and then I got desperate again, and I was screaming at my daughter. I'd gotten married, and my husband and I had a business, and we had a beautiful 4-year-old, 3-year-old daughter, and every night I would get down on my knees and I would pray. I'd say, please God, help me not to scream at her tomorrow. And every morning I would get up and I would remind myself of that prayer. And I would think, when she can't get out of the, she's a late walker. I said, when she doesn't get out of the car seat fast enough, please God help me not to scream at her. And I'd remind myself about that prayer, and we'd have to go someplace, and I'd put her in the car seat, and I'd scream at her when she wasn't getting out of the car fast enough. And that night I'd get down on my knees, I'd pray again, I'd say, please God, please help me not. You know, and I knew that I was not a poster child for the joy of living or anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so God intervened, as he will, if you're open. And thank God I was. And a friend of mine that I had been active with had gotten moved to a different area of the country from where she had gotten sober and from where I was living at the time. And she got active in the book, and she started, you know, doing the deal and started. And I watched her. I watched what happened to her, and I said, I have to have this thing. And I started doing the work, and I got a sponsor by referral. So for anybody, if there's any newcomers in the room that think you have to pick the perfect sponsor or interview them or get their credentials, you know, it's okay. You can just be desperate and just ask somebody. Just ask somebody. So this was a referral. I started calling her. I never even met her, never heard her speak. And she started taking me through the book, and I didn't know where we were. We're somewhere in the first step, you know, like page 42, I don't know. And my daughter was, I was out in the yard working, and I could hear my daughter start to cry in the car. In the house, and you know how you can tell blood's not flowing. So I didn't rush in. I just kind of ambled in, and I said, "Honey, what's the matter?" And she said, "Oh, I just this drawer that you and Daddy just got fixed, I pulled it out of the drawer, and everything fell all over, and I think I broke it again." And I said, "Oh, well, you know, we had the repair guy come the day before, and I said, well, let's see if we can fix it." So I, you know, put the stuff back in the drawer, and, you know, I jimmied it on the wheel, and I pushed it back in. And I said, see, honey, it's fine. Don't worry. And she said, she looked at me and she said, you're not mad, Mommy? And I wasn't. I wasn't trying to control it. I wasn't like, I'm just frustrated. I was just like, like the book says, the problem had been removed. And I had only done this little teeny thing. I'd just taken this little baby step. And I'm so grateful. And that baby is 17 today. And, you know, most of the time, we have a really good relationship, in spite of teenageness, and in spite of my teenageness. I call up my sponsor, and she reminds me that my daughter has yet to develop frontal lobes. And then she reminds me that mine aren't in the best shape either. But the biggest thing that the greatest direction that came out of that from my sponsor was, she said, do you remember what you were like to your mother? And I remember what I was like to my mother. And my mother passed, actually, 6 years ago, June 30th, the day before yesterday. And so I've been thinking a lot about her and about my dad, who passed November 17th. So we're still in our first year yard site. So what she said was, you know, make amends to your mother. So out of that, when I want to just pinch my daughter's head off, I think about my mother, and I'm able to be kind and loving and patient because I know I was powerless. I know I'm powerless over these things. I got to get going. I've had the book talks about emotional sobriety a lot. Talks about how we have emotional stability in relationships regarding money, and the two words that seem to be repeated over and over again in this chapter of ours is God and action. And so I've had to take some action, and as a result, you know, I do what you guys tell me to do, and I get all this credit. I had the privilege of escorting my grand sponsor to the airport after we had an event, and to help her kind of navigate with her bag. And I noticed that on the way, as we got onto the plane, there were some servicemen sitting there, and she walked by and she said, "Thank you for your service." And I thought, I wish I had said that. So last weekend, I was taking my son and my daughter to Pete's. We were out kind of just having a little afternoon together. And while we were ordering, I noticed that there was a serviceman standing by, you know, sitting by the door. And, you know, of course I get nervous. I think, oh, God, he's going to think I'm crazy. What did I say? I don't want to do it. You know, the committee starts meeting. So I just said, screw it. And as we were leaving, I said to myself, if he's still there, give me the courage to say thank you and follow Peg's example. And so he was still there, and I just went by and I said, thank you for your service. And we walked out of the store, and my son looked up at me and he said, that was nice, Mommy. And I said, I learned how to do that in AA. I do this stuff, stupid stuff, you know, that I don't think is going to matter, that isn't going to change the quality of my life, and changes me and the quality of my life on a cellular level, that I become changed. When we were going through a really hard time with our father, the last 5 years of his life were just a long, slow, gradual, painful decline and withdrawal. And it was just like inch by inch. And my brother in Chicago was really kind of the point person on this, with my sister's help, but my sister dealt with it a little bit better than my brother did. And he was always in so much pain, and I'd call him up and he was just so angry at me that I didn't live in Chicago and wasn't helping out. And one time he was particularly, well, mean, frankly, and I called up my sponsor expecting her to take my side. Dream on. this and he said that. And his, you know, his birthday was coming up. And she said, he's a saint. Saint? You know, I'm like, that's not what I was thinking he was. So I just said, okay, so one of those times, you know, like when your sponsor talks to you and you're having a hard time hearing her, and it's like somebody, like her hands are on the inside of your skull squeezing your brain. Yeah, that's what it's like. And it's like, oh, God, I'm not ever going to get this, you know, all straightened up. And just keep talking. Just keep talking. I'm going to listen. I'm not going to say anything. And she said, you ought to think of doing something for him. And I said, I have thought. He doesn't go out. He doesn't, you know, he's, you know, denial about his drinking. He can't do anything for the guy. Blah, blah, blah. You know, she said, well, you know, she said, really? You know, and then I thought, well, he smokes cigars. She said, that's a good idea. Get him cigars. So I go, okay. So I go, you know, so that, you know, that, like, week in the mail comes a catalog for cigars.com. You know, because you get the direction and you have to kind of let it ferment a little, you know. You don't do it right away. I'm like, okay, you know. This is one thing I wanted to remember. You know, in the beginning, my prayer, you know, like when I would finally start to get to pray was, no, I don't think so, you know. And then it was like, okay, okay, you know, somewhere like in the teens, you know. Like now, my prayer is, really? You want me to what? You know, I mean, that's really what it's come down to, which I guess is sort of a bizarre track of surrender in a way. So I had this thing with my brother. So I got him, you know, I ordered him the cigars and they came. And he left me a voicemail. And he went on and on about what a wonderful sister I was, how nobody ever got him anything, how nobody had ever bought him cigars before. He was just so thrilled with them. They were the perfect kind. They were exactly what he wanted. How did I know? Blah, blah. I let my sponsor listen to it, you know. And, you know, and she, you know. You know, when I do what you guys tell me to do, God does my life. You know, I don't have to worry about this stuff. I haven't spent one second on my marriage since I got here. I wasn't married when I got here. You know, well, I had been married twice before. But I was currently single. You know, I haven't spent one second on that. I've just done what you've told me to do. My atheist husband. You know, when I went to, you know, here he'd been with me, you know, he'd never seen me drink, been with me for like 8 years. I, you know, my program consisted of, you know, one meeting a week if I was in town. And, you know, instead of my calling sponsor and calling sponsees and getting sponsees and going to retreats and going to conferences and doing all this stuff. And I went to my first retreat and I was back a couple of days and he said, you can go to one of those anytime you want. You have been an angel since you got home. So I don't have to worry about, I don't have to worry about my job. I, you know, and my disease will come up with stuff still today. It's like, okay, focus over here. And you have to fix this right away, you know. And then I thank God I have AA, and I called my sponsor. I, you know, got some sponsor. He called me with the exact same lie. And I could say, no, you know, no, don't do that. Just do AA. Just do AA. And these things happen for us. So at the end of the 12 and 12, which my sponsor pointed out to me this morning, which I promised to give her credit for, but it's always a, not always sure that's going to happen. It says, it changes to good living. Understanding is the key to right principles and attitudes, and right action is the key to good living. Therefore, the joy of good living is the theme of AA's 12 steps. Thank you for my good life. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my family. Thank you for my friends. Thank you for my job. Thank you for every good thing that I have ever, ever had in this life. Amen.
Wow. You listen to these three testaments of what it used to be like and what it's like now, and AA works. Thank you all. My name is Hank, and I'm an alcoholic. When I was listening to Santiago share, it reminded me so much of my drinking days, which were not happy ones for many, many years. And I especially remember the few years before AA when I would wake up and maybe there was a woodpecker pecking on the chimney and I would swear at him and I would curse the sun coming through, the rays coming through the window. And I would want to die. And that's how I woke up. Morning after morning after morning, wanting to die. I said there was no joy before AA. There was a joy. I managed to stay sober while my first wife was pregnant with our son. And when he was born, my heart was filled with joy. He is my heart. My son is my heart. Jonah is my heart. But a while after he was born, and I had started drinking again, my wife said to me, she had never said anything about my drinking, but she said, "You are the most depressing man I have ever known." Jonah was like 10 months at the time. "You're the most depressing man I have ever known, and I don't want our son to grow up around someone like you. You need to leave." And that was the end. When I was brought by a power greater than me, and I didn't believe in God before AA, I absolutely do today. It's not a requirement. We don't have to believe in God, but we do have to find a power greater than us. But when I came through that doorway, I was filled with self-loathing, self-hatred. Couldn't imagine having any purpose, any worth at all. And yet I managed to, with a little coaxing, ask someone, and I agree, just ask somebody, don't make a big deal out of it, to be my sponsor. And he said, and I want us to practice these last two steps together, step 11 and step 12. And we're going to go to the shelter together. I was sober a couple of weeks, and I thought, I have nothing to share with these men who also have nothing. So he said, "Will you carry the books? Smile if you can." And we went to the shelter, and I smiled a bit and shook some hands and gave him the books. And when we were done, we were driving back. And he said, "You know, this 12th step, hey, number one, it's the very best way to stay sober a day at a time is to help somebody else. And it will also help you to deal with your problem, which is you, to deal with your selfishness and self-centeredness." He said, "You did good." And you know, after being so filled with that loathing and worthlessness for so long, for the first time in a long, long time, there was a little bit of joy. There was a little bit of joy. And as you said, Bill doesn't repeat himself very much. in any of those books. But in the 12 of 12, at the beginning, it says, the joy of living is a theme of the 12th step. And at the end of the same chapter, he says, again, the joy of living is the theme of step 12. And I absolutely believe that. He also said I needed to have some kind of a spiritual breakfast, a way to start the day. He said somebody like you, selfish and self-centered in the extreme, full of pride, I want you to pray. He said, I want you to pray this third step prayer. We're not there, but I want you to pray it. And you need to get on your knees and pray it. And I'd never done that. And I was alone in my tiny little apartment that I used to call my cell. I think it was the tiniest apartment in North Carolina. And it was so hard to get on my knees. And then, after a time, he said, prayer is great, but there's more to step 11 than prayer. He said, you need to try this thing called meditation. And he said, however you want to do it is okay. It's like prayer. There's no right way to pray or wrong way. There's no right or wrong way to meditate. And I have tried to do that. It is not easy, as we all know, to be still and listen to that voice in here. Listen to that voice. But there comes sometimes, just being still, a smile comes. And a joy. And I can only explain that, as I think Santiago did so well, that there is a beautiful, wonderful source of joy in this universe. The other thing, and the part of the reason I'm trying to be specific, is one of my sponsees recently said, well, you know, all that talk sounds great, but tell me specifically, how can I find some joy? What can I do? What do I have to do? Help somebody else. Meditate. And the other thing is that you all told me, and this was so very, very important, because I had no hope before. I had tried and tried to get sober for about as many years as you did. Do you ever have a brain fart? The idea that I only had to stay sober just for the day was like really huge. I don't have to quit it for the rest of this month or this week, just for today. And later on, my sponsor said, try to live not just for today. Try to live right now. Live in this moment. So when you're walking down the street and you hear that woodpecker again up on your chimney, you can smile at him. When you see those beautiful flowers as you're driving down these wonderful highways in Texas, and you can say, wow, they're so beautiful. When I'm with another human being or human beings and feel that connectedness, that beautiful language of the heart that we speak. And I'm not thinking about what am I going to be saying in 15 seconds or how did I do what I said 15 seconds ago. If I'm right here, right now, in this moment, there is joy. And I am truly alive. And I have only learned that here with you all. Such a joy to be here this morning. It's such a joy to share a panel with three beautiful people. And I appreciate you all coming. And have a wonderful convention.